surely," said Manning. "You can't think she recalls that."
"I had a hobby horse when I was 4," said Salzburg. "It was white, with blue glass eyes, and an improbably orange mane. I rode it everywhere, though I had no recollection of it until some workmen stumbled upon it while clearing out a lumber room a few years ago. As soon as I saw it, I was transported back to a very particular day when I saw my father beating my mother for something involving the gardener. My mother was, I knew even then, not someone to be trusted. But the incident came back to me with extraordinary clarity. Which cane he used, the sprinkle of blood on the hearth where she fell. It was really quite remarkable." He said this with the same eerie and unflinching smile, so that even Manning, who was used to him, looked momentarily unnerved. "The mind is a curious thing," Salzburg concluded. "You never know what discarded details might float to the surface."
His phone rang. Latrange again.
"Well?" Salzburg demanded.
"Washington, D.C., said Latrange. "She tried to throw us off track by buying a ticket to Jamaica on her credit card, but then paying cash to change the destination. Fortunately, our people got into the passenger manifest."
"Ah," said Salzburg, satisfied. "Then all may be dealt with expeditiously. We have some good people in the United States, and they are already alerted because of the so-called web journalist Tamika Mars."
"You need me to go after her?" asked Latrange. "I have, as you know, other duties."
"Indeed," Salzburg replied. "And I only hope that you perform those with greater professionalism. But no, leave her alone for now. Other operatives will tidy up your mess. But wait one moment." He pressed the phone to his breast pocket and said to the man opposite him, "Herr Manning, how would you feel about a journey across the Atlantic?" Manning shrugged and nodded. "Excellent," said Salzburg. He spoke into the phone. "You are in luck, Daniel. Herr Manning and myself will be following in Miss Quinn's blundering wake." Latrange's half-suppressed gasp of surprise amused Salzburg, whose skeletal grin spread wider than ever. "You? You are going yourselves?" said Latrange. "Things are moving rather more swiftly than I had anticipated," he said. "We would need to go sooner or later. It may as well be sooner. I would hate not to be on hand to see it all in person."
"Right," said Latrange.
"Okay.
Oh, and Daniel?" said Salzburg, still beaming at Manning.
"Yes?"
"No more mistakes, yes," he said. "And do not allow yourself, even for the briefest of moments, to forget where your loyalties lie. That would be most unwise."
The momentary hesitation at the end of the phone, before Latrange's babbled, "Of course," spoke volumes about the operative's sudden terror. Salzburg's smile grew even wider.
32. Tamika, Pottsville, Pennsylvania.
Katerina Lundegrass had cornered Tamika in the hallway as the younger woman tried to slip out of the retirement home unnoticed.
"You don't give up, do you?" she said, the firmness of her voice and steadiness of her gaze completely belying her age.
"Did you want me to?"
"What does that mean?"
"You sent me to a church full of paper children," said Tamika. "I remembered what you said when I first asked you about the people at the Hollows. Paper people, you said." Katerina smiled a little sadly.
"Stupid of me," she said. "An old weakness of mine. I can't resist giving hints just to bleak enough to keep me on the windy side of the law."
"Your father was an Operation Paperclip scientist," said Tamika.
"Yes,"
said the old woman simply. "A low-ranking rocket propulsion technician at Kummersdorf. He wasn't a Nazi, ever. He worked briefly at the Langley Aeronautical Laboratory, and a few other places."
"And this is why you are here, all of you? Why? That work is a matter of public record."
"It is," she said. "As the policeman would say, nothing to see here."
"Are you prisoners here?" She smiled again at that, wide, but slightly rueful.
Jersey came to think so. But no, not really. We are looked after. The government considers it a debt they owe to our fathers.
It can't be that simple, said Tamika, her voice low, her eyes on the end of the hallway, where someone less friendly might appear at any moment.
There's too much secrecy. Look, said Katerina with a shrug. Some of what our fathers worked on was classified. Some of it is still considered sensitive. My father worked on rockets. Some of that helped put men into space. But it was also tied into missile systems. He consulted at Los Alamos in the late 40s. People don't want to be reminded that the U.S. had German specialists working on their nuclear weapons right after the war. It's, she searched for the word, ungehörig, unseemly. But everyone already knows that, Tamika persisted. There's got to be more to it. Ms. Lundegrass, I think you liked Jersey a lot. Maybe you were in love with him. He wanted to tell me about his past, and someone killed him for it. There must be something you can tell me. Something that would help me figure out where to look next. For his sake.
For a long moment, the old woman just looked at her. Then someone called her name from the kitchen.
Be right there,
she sang back, her eyes never leaving Tamika's. Please, said Tamika.
Someone came after me, shot at me. Probably the same person who killed Jersey.
Finding out why won't save you, said Katerina.
It might, said Tamika. And if it doesn't, at least I'll die knowing what I got involved in.
Katerina's eyes narrowed.
You think that will be a consolation? She said. Knowing something no one wants you to know? It won't. Trust me, it really won't.
Tamika frowned. I'd like to make that decision for myself, she said. Katerina considered her. The noises in the kitchen were getting louder, closer.
There is a second-story window at the back of the hollows, under a copper cupola, and a ladder by the greenhouse, down the side of the house. The window will be open at 11 o'clock tonight. I will give you 30 minutes.
Tamika left the retirement home the way she'd come, and drove away from town, stopping to eat at the second exit, advertising food and gas. She bought both, then considered her remaining funds. She couldn't live off the rent money she had withdrawn in New York indefinitely, and daren't try using her credit cards. Most of her family and friends were in New York. She knew no one around here who might help her out. If she abandoned the idea of returning to New York, her closest family was her cousin Tonya, who worked for a museum in Atlanta. Maybe she would head in that direction and see what she could borrow. Depending, of course, on what, if anything, Katerina offered her tonight. As the terror of the chase receded, she found herself almost forgetting that she was still in real danger, and that there was something out there she needed to find. Maybe, she reasoned, as she munched on yet another generic burger. It was all over already. Maybe she should get on with her life. But what had her life been to this point? If it wasn't chasing after truth amongst the misdirection and clutter, the wishful thinking, and the outright lies of the contemporary world. And maybe, just maybe, she was chasing the story of her career. Not for debunction, but for Time magazine or Newsweek. This might be what her professional life and her bank account needed, a jump start. She called Dion, but he didn't pick up. She kept her message short and unspecific. She'd be back soon, but didn't know when. She missed him. After she hung up and turned off her phone, she wondered a little about that last remark. She missed a lot of things about her life in New York, including him. But did she miss him the way lovers were supposed to? Like she might miss a part of herself. A constant burning absence that made her feel somehow incomplete. It had never occurred to her to share what she was doing with him, not because she was being secretive, but because she knew how his eyes would glaze over, how he would tune her out and make noises into the phone, while his eyes strayed to the muted basketball game on the TV, or the Call of Duty game he was playing on the Xbox. She shook her head. This wasn't the time to dwell on such things. She considered calling her cousin Tanya, just to take her mind off it all and to prime the pump, as it were, in case she needed to recruit her help. But Atlanta was far away. Surely it wouldn't come to that. She parked under the scrawny, neglected trees of a strip mall and sat listening to Motown on an oldie station as the sun started to set. Then she turned the key and set off for the Hollows, humming along to Marvin Gaye's "What's Going On?" Seems appropriate, she thought, as the weary Corolla nosed its way into the gathering night. She drove past the Hollow's entry gate, trying to find her way around to the fence she had scaled on her way out. It wasn't easy in the dark. She couldn't help thinking that the lack of street lighting around the old house was deliberate. There would be cameras, she imagined. Whether there was night vision or thermal imaging equipment depended on just how protective the government wanted to be about keeping any foxes out of their geriatric henhouse. Assuming it was the government. Assuming Katerina hadn't spun a pack of lies to lure Tamika to who knew what. Get on with it, she told herself. There would be time to agonize over what it all meant later. Very existential. She shook herself. All this solitude and driving was making her crazy. She checked her watch and parked on the shoulder, tucking one fender into a screen of densely packed cedar. She wondered if she needed a gun, but had no idea how she would have gone about acquiring one here. In New York, she knew exactly where she would have gone. Then again, if she needed to go directly to the cops, she didn't want a sketchy handgun receipt and a glove box full of ammo complicating the conversation. And besides, she thought, as she began the slow walk along the dark and narrow road to the Hollows, she didn't like guns. Dion had one, but she insisted he keep it locked up at all times. It made her nervous. She could always tell when he was carrying it. It gave him a swaggering confidence she didn't like. The black outlines of the trees ahead parted for a second, and she saw the steep gables of the Hollows set back from the road. Tamika checked the position of the crescent moon to get her bearings, and pushed along until she found the spot on the fence where she had clambered over from the other side. If a car came by, she could be conspicuous. And climbing the fence was easier said than done. She'd gotten out by shinnying up a tree, but there was no such vegetation on this side. She could just about reach the top of the fence when she stood on her tiptoes, but she didn't have the arm strength to haul herself up, and the fence provided no obliging crevices in which she might wedge a shoe for leverage. She tried a standing leap, but succeeded only in bashing her knees before dropping into a ditch. She was suddenly struck by a memory she hadn't recalled in years, climbing those damned ropes in high school gym, while the teacher, Ms. Keaton, smirked at her and told her she might want to go easy on the cheeseburgers. Good thing she didn't see what I had for dinner, Tamika thought, scowling at the fence and the darkness. She cursed under her breath and looked around for an object she might use as a step. Something lay in the ditch, to her left. She picked her way toward it and found a section of sawn-off telephone pole, about 3 feet long. She tried to pick it up, feeling the wet coldness underneath it when she slid her hands around it. It was surprisingly heavy. She flipped it around and rolled it to where the fence was most accessible, pushing it with her feet and wheezing slightly, muttering with each shove, "I was not built to be a spy." She propped it up against the fence, took a moment to get her breath back, and then climbed up with one foot, boosting herself up. As she adjusted her weight, the fragment of telephone pole pushed out from under her and rolled into the ditch. But she had her elbows on the top railing and, with a struggle, was able to hoist her way up. With another concerted effort, she climbed up and over. It wasn't a graceful landing, but she did herself no serious injury. She was in. "You see that, Ms. Keaton? You sanctimonious crone? You owe me a burger." The woods were dense. Finally, the house rose into view. Even then, it was difficult to make out exactly where she was, because there were no lights on. Everyone, it seemed, had turned in for the night. Old people, she thought. She skulked her way to the edge by the golf course and approached the house from the side, breaking into a low trot as she crossed the open space leading to the greenhouse. The ladder rested on a pair of hooks fastened into the wall. She was relieved to find it was made of lightweight aluminum. One of the old wooden kind would have been impossible to lift. She got it balanced and carried it toward the house, eyeing the copper cupola Katerina had told her about. The window below it was closed. Another wild goose chase? Or worse? She consulted her watch. 10:58. She'd made good time. As she watched, the window was pushed discreetly open, an inch and a half. There was no sign of the hand that did it. This was no time for hesitation. "In for a penny," her grandmother used to say. "In for a pound." She lifted the end of the ladder, raised it above her head like a weightlifter switching grips, and walked under it, moving down the rungs till the ladder was vertical. With a series of little steps, her gaze up so that the ladder wouldn't overbalance, she walked it to within a few feet of the wall and lowered the top of the ladder against the house. It made a slight clatter on contact, but that couldn't be helped. She waited. No one seemed to have heard. She began to climb, slowly, carefully, quietly, feeling the ladder shift and groan slightly under her weight, so that for a second she stopped, her heart in her throat. She heard nothing. Tamika pressed on, rung by rung, and hand over hand, staring fixedly up at her goal, then pulled the window open. Slowly, quietly, slid her head under it, and pushed it wider with her back and shoulders. As with the dismount from the fence, there was no elegant way to finish her entrance, and she wound up half-walking on her hands across the carpet, until her feet fell in after her. "At least I'm not wearing a dress," she muttered, as she got upright and flopped heavily into a wing-back armchair. Katerina Lundegrass turned on her bedside lamp and pulled the heavy drapes closed. She was wearing a flannel nightgown under a heavy bathrobe, belted with a silk sash, and looked ghostly in the thin light. She was unsmiling, but she was also alone and, as far as Tamika could see, unarmed. "So," Tamika hissed, "what in God's name do you have to tell me that makes all of that worth it?" "Not to tell," said the old woman. "To show." She opened a drawer in the cabinet by her bed, reached into the back, and drew out what looked like a cloth package. She unwrapped it carefully, lovingly, revealing a patch of silvery metal, about 4 inches long and diamond-shaped, though the edges were ragged and crumpled. It glowed softly in the lamplight, so that Tamika could make out odd symbols etched, or rather polished, into the dull surface. "What is that?" asked Tamika. "Here," said Katerina, scrunching it up like a candy wrapper. "Feel it." Tamika reached out, palm up. Katerina laid the little screw of foil on it, but as soon as she let go, it sprang open again, showing not a single crease or fold. Tamika stared at it, caught up in a sudden unexpected sense of strangeness. The metal felt odd, light and pliable, but strong. It was also slightly warm. As she held it,
She thought the strange symbols glowed faintly, as if catching some distant firelight.
See? Said Katerina, reaching out, and sweeping one gnarled finger along the length of the metal. The touch seemed to bring the metal to life in Tamika's hands. It blushed a cool blue color that cast shadows around the room. Tamika gasped and almost dropped it, as if it were too hot to hold. It wasn't, but it felt curiously charged, as if it somehow contained something of Katerina's energy, or her own.
What the hell is this? Tamika whispered. Where did you get it?
My father gave it to me, Katerina said. A souvenir.
Of something he built?
The old woman shook her head. Her hair, which had been pinned back before, now hung long and white, almost to her waist. In the strange blue glow of the metal, it shone like a halo.
He didn't build it, she said. He found it.
When? Where?
I told you he worked in Los Alamos, in New Mexico, in the 40s, yes?
Tamika nodded, barely able to take her eyes off the pulsing scrap of metal.
He was called in to examine some materials, she said, smiling wistfully at the memory. It was all very hush-hush, and he really shouldn't have shown it to me, let alone brought a piece of it from the facility. But he knew I would love it. I've kept it ever since. My secret. My little piece of the past. Apart from Jersey, you were the only person I've ever shown it to.
And it came from Los Alamos? Tamika pressed, feeling the warmth ripple around the metal fragment, as if blood surged within it.
Like it's alive.
No, said Katerina. He was called over from Los Alamos. It was July 8, 1947. I remember him getting the call, and the two of us driving out in the middle of the night. Get dressed, little Katie, he said. We have to go out.
She looked suddenly sad, wistful, the memory stirring something complicated that had more to do with her father than with the scrap of metal they were talking about.
Where did you go? Asked Tamika.
What? Said Katerina, coming back to the moment with an effort.
The two of you drove out at night and came back with this, said Tamika patiently, holding the metal fragment up. Where did you go?
Katerina looked up from the metal, her face mildly surprised, unearthly in the shifting blue glow coming from Tamika's hands.
Oh, I assumed you knew that, she said. It came from Roswell.
33. Jersey. La Plata, Argentina. October 1946. It was 4 days since the USS Kitchener had arrived in Argentine waters. The captain had met with the various officials and diplomats, and it was 2 days since he told me of his dual loyalties to the Navy and to this new intelligence service. I had not spoken to him since then, and had said nothing of my conversation with him to anyone else. Not that anyone cared. The crew had been given shore leave, released to the bars and dance halls of Buenos Aires, and none of my shipmates were in any great hurry to get back to open water. I stayed on board, reading a collection of speeches from Shakespeare and enjoying the rare silence of the crew quarters. No one, so far as I knew, had guessed that I was younger than I claimed to be. But at times like this, with the rest of the crew hankering after liquor and women, I felt like a child. My English was much improved now, but old books, Dickens say, still gave me difficulties from time to time. And the Shakespeare was especially hard, since many of the words were not in the dictionary I kept at hand. When I heard movement on the gangway, my first impulse was to ask a question, without even looking up from the pages in my hand. "What does interred mean?" I called out. "The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often interred with their bones." "Buried," said the captain's voice. I swung down from my bunk and stood at attention.
At ease, seaman, said Captain Jennings. He considered the empty berths. Just you?
Everyone went to town, I said.
Not you, though, he said.
I raised the book in explanation, and he smiled.
Julius Caesar, eh? He said, peering at the text.
Yes, sir.
Treachery and ambition, he summarized. Don't you get enough of that on board?
No one has been stabbed to death, I said.
Though if they weren't able to get ashore.
Indeed, said Jennings, which is what I wanted to speak to you about.
Sir?
I wonder if you would go inland for me. Let's call it recon.
Of what?
Not what, he qualified.
Who?
The SS officer, I said.
Kamler?
I want to know where they went, he replied. Our diplomatic friends had some leads, but Perrone and his government aren't saying anything. You're going to have to poke around a bit.
I don't speak Spanish.
You won't be alone. One of the diplomats from the meeting the other day, Hartsfeld, the translator, will be with you, and I'm going to assign another crewman, Petty Officer Belasco. Hartsfeld will supply a local driver, so language won't be a problem.
A driver? Are we going far? I asked.
Frankly, yes. If our information is correct, Kamler and some others, probably Nazis, some of whom were part of the crew of the Graf Spee, who spent some of the war here. We think they went inland and north, close to Paraguay. It's a good 400 miles on difficult roads, which is why you need to make a start as soon as possible. Looks like we'll be tied up in red tape for a week or more here, but once we get our orders, we'll have to ship out right away. I want you and the others off at first light and, if possible, back here in 4 days.
Yes, sir.
And Jersey, he added. Keep your wits about you. Something in his manner got my attention.
Who don't you trust? I asked.
The Nazis have not just had help inside Perón's regime. Someone has been covering for them diplomatically, too. Someone we consider one of ours.
You think it could be Hartsfeld?
I don't know, he said. But as I say, keep your wits about you. I didn't like Belasco. He was Mexican by heritage. But while some of the other Hispanics aboard were shy, unsure of themselves among the largely white crew, he was a meaty, swaggering brute, a bully with a crude sense of humor, who'd taken my copy of Bleak House and thrown it over the side during our first week at sea.
Books? He had scoffed. What are you, a girl?
His buddies had laughed and made pouty lips and kissy noises at me, but he hadn't done it to amuse them, and that somehow made it worse. I avoided him for the bulk of the voyage, and had watched him push down the gangplank toward the dance halls of Buenos Aires, with something like relief. The prospect of traveling 400 miles on the back of a jeep with him settled in my gut like nausea. It kept me awake much of the night. I hid my nervousness as best I could when meeting with the captain before we embarked. But he spotted it and gave me an encouraging pat on the shoulder.
Remember that for some of the men you were looking for, he said, the war is not over. Never will be. I just want a good sense of where they are. That's all. Do not engage or make any attempt to capture or communicate.
Yes, sir, we answered in unison. Mark Hatzfeld is to be treated as mission commander, he added. You will treat his word as if it is mine.
Yes, sir.
He caught my eye but didn't hold it. Whatever concerns he might have about Hatzfeld were clearly not to be shared.
And be on your guard in the jungle, he said. There are more than Nazis to worry about.
It was supposed to be a joke, but it didn't quite come across that way. I wanted to ask about how to deal with Belasco, but didn't know how to frame the question. He was older, in his late 20s, more experienced and more confident than I. And as a petty officer, he outranked me. In my heart, I thought him less intelligent. But even then, I knew that stupidity wasn't necessarily a hindrance to command, and in fact, it made some things a lot easier. I was, I decided with a teenager's hubris, more like Hamlet, deeper and more reflective, paralyzed by my own complexity.
Thank God I didn't try to say such a thing to Captain Jennings or, for that matter, anyone else. The fact remained. I say I didn't like Belasco, but the truth was that I was afraid of him. I didn't think he would stab me in my sleep or otherwise do me serious injury, but he oozed a constant low-grade capricious malice that could, I felt, turn nasty at any moment. I worried more about him, my comrade in arms, than about the Nazis I was hunting. Briefed, though less fully than I'd expected, given what I already knew, we left the captain's office with our packs slung over our shoulders. We had each been issued M1911 automatics, but were ordered not to wear them on our belts until we were away from the city. I could feel the extra weight in my pack. As we descended the gangplank to the launch that would ferry us ashore, Belasco gave me a sidelong look and grinned maliciously. "Ready for a little adventure, Polak?" he said. "Won't be no reading on this trip." "Shut up, Belasco," I said casually, not looking at him. He chuckled at my feigned defiance. "Oh, yeah," he said, not even bothering to address my insubordination. "We're going to have a high time." Hartsfeld, the diplomat and translator, met us at the queue. He was a thin man with wire-rimmed glasses and a lawyerly air, in a pale linen suit and a blue shirt. He looked ordinary, but I was wary of him because of what Captain Jennings had said, even if he hadn't pinned his doubts on Hartsfeld exactly. His driver, whom he introduced simply as Ignacio, was my age, heavily tanned with lank black hair that fell to his shoulders in ways I had never seen on a boy before. He spoke no English and seemed taken aback by Belasco, who made a joke in Spanish as they loaded the truck. Hartsfeld had procured a long-bodied four-wheel drive vehicle, like a Willys Jeep, but with an extra storage row behind the rear seat. It was built for rough terrain and tended to bounce, something Ignacio, who was no taller than I, and almost as slight, dwarfed by the steering wheel and gear shift, seemed to relish. It was a pleasant day in Buenos Aires, the cold southern hemisphere winter long over, and the city enjoying the last mild days of spring as the weather warmed. I loved it, and not only because we would be pressing north into the steamy heat of the jungle. It reminded me of my boyhood in Poland, even the buildings recalling something of an old European grandeur. "Look at the tits on her," remarked Belasco, pointing at a girl in a red dress who was crossing the street. He whistled, shouting something in Spanish that made Ignacio laugh. But Hartsfeld, who also spoke Spanish, turned from the passenger seat and gave him a disapproving look. For her part, the girl glared at the car, and when Belasco made more lewd noises, she fired back a stream of invective. That just made him laugh harder than ever. We left behind the broad tree-lined avenidas with their elaborate classicist buildings, obelisks, and equestrian statues, finding our way north, out of the city proper, and up Highway 12 along the Uruguayan border. The road deteriorated quickly, and within a few hours, we were jolting along lanes of packed earth, where hard ruts and hollows suggested serious flooding in the rainy season. But the land was flat, and we made good speed. "Pampas," said Ignacio, playing tour guide, nodding at the grassy plains on either side of the long straight road. Near Paysandú, we stopped to eat at a roadside steakhouse populated by Argentine cowboys called gauchos, saving the rations we brought for less populated regions ahead. Belasco bought beer, staring Hartsfeld down when the diplomat gave him a look. "What?" he said. "Not on board, not on base. Hell, I don't even know whether we're on mission." "You are," said Hartsfeld, "and I'm in command. I thought that was clear." Belasco shrugged. "Okay," he said, pointedly draining his bottle in three long swallows. "See? No beer." Hartsfeld's lip twitched, as if he had been about to say something else, but he let it go. Somewhere north of Salto, the road began to deteriorate even further.
Soon we dropped to half the speed we'd been doing, and within another hour, half that again. Belasco squeezed in beside me and flexed his shoulders, so we took up three-quarters of the room, cursing in Spanish and English. Hartsfeld checked his watch. We had only another hour or so of daylight remaining, and we were seeing fewer and fewer signs of civilization as we climbed. In the storage rack at the back of the vehicle, we had a canvas tent and bedrolls, but we'd hoped to stay in hotels where possible. We gave it another 45 minutes, but Hartsfeld had clearly been getting antsy as the sun got lower in the sky, and I wasn't surprised when he called it. "Pull over there," he said. "We'll camp for the night and get back on the road at sunup." Belasco was, predictably, unhappy. "I don't see why we can't drive for another hour or two," he said. "So it gets dark. Big deal." "We can't pitch a tent in the kind of darkness they have out here," said Hartsfeld. "You can't," muttered Belasco. "I can do all kinds of things in the dark. Right, Pollock?" I said nothing, unsure if that was supposed to be a joke or a threat. Maybe he didn't know either. So we pitched the tent in a clearing beside the road, Belasco giving the orders throughout, and made a fire on which we put a kettle of water, which tasted of the iron jerry can. There was some bread, cheese, and apples, the only perishable food we had brought with us, and whatever we chose to supplement it with from our own rations. While the rest of us worked, Hartsfeld set up the radio and sent a message in Morse code, presumably to the captain. He saw me watching him and hesitated before giving me a nod. "Something I can help you with, seaman?" "No, sir," I said. It was a warm night, warmer than it had been in Buenos Aires. The open plains had given way to low hills and patchy woodland. It wasn't jungle, certainly not the impenetrable and swampy wall of vegetation that I associated with the term. But we were getting there slowly. You could hear the difference in the night air, the bird calls and other unfamiliar, unnerving shrieks. And it was at least as dark as it had been in those Polish forests, when even the neighboring villages had been blacked out. I didn't want to go into the tent with Belasco, but sitting out in the night by myself, eating canned beans with a spoon, was starting to get to me. As we drove, Belasco had told stories of the vampire bats that crawled up to you as you slept and slashed your ear or your wrist with their teeth, lapping at the blood with their tongues. Ignacio, the boy driver, confirmed Belasco's tales in enthusiastic Spanish. "Sometimes they come back to the same cow or donkey night after night until it bleeds to death," Belasco said. "If they hit a major artery, it will be over a lot sooner." He made gushing noises and gestured from his throat with a splayed hand and laughed as I turned away. At the time, I'd been more revolted than scared. But now, sitting in the dark, I felt a sudden longing to be back in Europe, far from the reach of such strange creatures. At least I had already emptied my bladder. Now I was just killing time, hoping that if I waited long enough, Belasco would be asleep when I crawled into the tent. I listened to the shifting and grunting under the canvas, keeping still, my flashlight off. There would be snakes up here, dangerous ones. Would they come out at night, or only during the day? I had no idea. I looked up at the night sky, the constellations so bright and distinct this far from the city lights, and the milky wash of other stars beyond them, clustered in their millions, like specks of dust. I was gazing blankly up when one of the stars began to move. 34. Alan, Dreamland, Nevada.
"You went to fucking Stonehenge?" Hatcher bellowed.
Murad and Alan were standing at attention for the first time in weeks.
"Yes, sir," said Alan.
"I take full responsibility, sir," said Murad.
"It's not like we were going to land or anything," Alan said.
Murat glanced at him, and Hatcher saw it.
"You've got to be kidding me," he said.
Did your last commanding officer have such a lax attitude toward orders that you felt empowered to do this?
No, sir, said Marat. It won't happen again, sir. It was my idea, Allen inserted. I insisted.
And did you visit any more of the UFO Club's favorite places? Hatcher barked. A flyover of the Great Pyramids, maybe.
Sir, no, sir, said Marat, humorless, eyes front. I was going to do that next time, said Allen.
There was a frosty silence, and Hatcher came very close to Allen.
You think this is funny, Major?
He demanded.
Just trying to lighten the mood, sir, Allen confessed in a low voice. It hadn't worked.
You think this is a game, Allen? Hatcher shot back. You think we're playing with toys here?
Allen thought for a second, then dropped something of the stiffness in his back and shoulders.
To be honest, sir, I really have no idea what we're doing, he said.
Surprised, Hatcher blinked, and Marat shot Allen a sideways look.
What's that supposed to mean?
Hatcher asked. But something of his rage had dissipated, and the question was not rhetorical.
I mean, said Allen carefully, you have these amazing crafts, and I'm delighted that you let me go up in them. But I don't understand what they're for, operationally. I don't know how we built them, or how they work, or why we aren't telling anyone else about them. And that's fine, sir. Most of it is fine, I guess. But when you ask me if we're playing, I genuinely don't know.
We are absolutely not playing, Major, said Hatcher, giving him a level stare. Allen's hesitation was only fractional, but it was loaded nonetheless.
Good to get that straight, sir, Allen replied. The CIA man looked poised to press the matter further, but decided to accept this at face value.
No more grandstanding nocturnal landings, said Hatcher.
Understood, sir.
And you follow orders to the letter?
Yes, sir. Absolutely, sir.
Good.
And, sir?
Yes, Major, said Hatcher, unwinding a little. What exactly are our orders?
Hatcher never answered Allen's question. The following day, he was sent up with Marat and the Great Black Triangle with a preset flight plan. But at no point did Hatcher so much as hint at what their larger mission might be. The day after that, Allen did not fly at all, spending his waking hours in a briefing room, going over the various readouts and procedures associated with the Locust. He was dining alone in the mess, veal saltimbocca with angel hair pasta, when a man came in. Allen had gotten used to not looking too closely at the people he saw on base, but sharing mess was so rare that he looked up, the forkful of food freezing en route to his mouth as he took in the bullish frame of a large black man. Staff Sergeant Barry Regis, the FAC he had last seen at Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan. He just stood there, head bowed, his eyes on Allen, who, reflexively, got to his feet so he could defend himself if necessary. The two men had not parted on good terms.
I was told I'd find you here, said Regis.
You were right, said Allen, watching him.
I was told a bunch of other stuff, too, said Regis, about what you do here and why they took you out of the Marines. They showed me what you fly, told me what you saw back in Afghanistan.
What happened?
Yeah, said Allen.
Yeah, he muttered. I'm sorry about Safed Co.
You should have said what happened. Allen heard the disbelief in his voice and couldn't help grinning. Regis matched his smile, and suddenly the two of them were laughing, and Regis was crossing the room and taking his hand.
You wouldn't have believed me, said Allen. I don't think I believed it. Not really. Not until I came here.
I get that, said Regis, sitting at Allen's table.
Still, you should have said, and I should have trusted you. I was just angry, man. I felt like those guys depended on me and I let them down. Guess I was looking for someone else to blame.
It's okay. What's a little awkward silence and pent-up aggression between Redhawks, right? Regis grinned with relief.
You still were the best pocket passer I ever protected, he said,
glad to change the subject.
Too bad I couldn't scramble worth a damn, said Allen. That's why you're in the cockpit, and I'm on the ground.
"Wasn't just physical, though, was it?" Alan said ruefully. "When you guys were around me, when I could sit back in the pocket and pick out my targets, I was fine. As soon as I felt it collapsing, panic, cluelessness, I got sacked more than a week of groceries." Regis laughed. "Wasn't so bad," he said, adding before Alan could protest. "And if you were, that was us. That's what the offensive line is for. You didn't let us down." Alan nodded gratefully, knowing they were talking about more than football. "And what about you?" said Alan. "Your job here, I mean. You still a Marine?"
"Technically, I'm private security for Dreamland, employed as of 2 days ago by the CIA fucking A, specialized skills officer. Not exactly what I was trained for, and I doubt I'll do much flying anymore, but they think my experience coordinating air and ground forces will be useful."
"Gotta say, Alan, this is some seriously wild shit."
"You got that right," said Alan.
Suddenly they were laughing again, as the tension dissipated. For Alan's part, with a sense of relief he hadn't realized he needed. Seeing Regis was like having a piece of the real world come back and agree with him about the strangeness of the universe. It was like finding a star to navigate by, and it calmed a dreadful loneliness he had not been aware he'd been feeling. It wasn't until later that he wondered if that had also been a factor in the decision to bring Regis inside Dreamland's cone of secrecy, a strategy to help their new pilot adjust to the strangeness of his new environment. He immediately rejected the idea as arrogant, but it left him uneasy nonetheless. The following day, Alan was called out to Papoose Lake again, and this time he was surprised to learn he would be flying alone, in a single-seat version of the two-man craft he'd flown on his last mission. He'd handled the controls by himself on his last flight, and had a good sense of how to activate all the craft's automated systems if he felt out of his depth. Having the cockpit to himself shouldn't have felt like a big deal, but it did. He suited up and climbed into the single-seat Locust, and went through the pre-flight protocols, feeling again a sense of glee. It was his now, like the Harrier he'd flown over Afghanistan was his. Alan was not a romantic. He did not refer to the planes he flew as if they were lovers, or pets, or any of the other terms he sometimes heard pilots use. An airplane was a machine, albeit a complex, even quirky one, and the Locust was no different. Yet it was also somehow alive, as all aircraft were, and it needed feeding and coaxing, reining in and urging on, tethering and unleashing. It was bigger than he was, and stronger, but he had to have mastery over it. He couldn't do that with a co-pilot or trainer sitting beside him. So he smiled as the hatch door latched closed. He entered the starting coordinates for today's mission. "Today you'll be flying in formation with Nightbird 1, said Hatcher's voice over his headset. "He will rendezvous with you at the assigned location." The assigned location was directly above Groom Lake, but they were to meet at 40,000 feet, considerably higher than Alan had been flying so far, and the craft was pressurizing around him as he climbed. Barat's voice came through his cans moments before he reached the rendezvous. "I have a visual on you now, Phoenix. Can you see me?" Alan checked his radar, spotted the point of light on the screen, and oriented to the appropriate window. The other black locust sat motionless in the bright air above him. "Got you," he said. "Where are we headed?" "Up," said Marat simply. "Come again?" "We're going high," said Marat. "Where you can't land and freak out the locals. We're going so far up that the word will stop meaning what you think it does." "I don't think I follow." "You will," said Marat, "in every sense." Alan grinned at the weak pun. "Right behind you," he said. There was a momentary pause, and then Marat's voice came back. "Okay, Phoenix. First thing you're going to do is angle one point of your triangle directly up, perpendicular to the ground." "We can't just drift up the way we came?" asked Alan, feeling an edge of unease. This was new territory. "Not this time." "What are we doing exactly?" "Leaving the atmosphere," said Marat. Alan put one hand to the earphone and pressed it to his head. "Can you repeat that?" he said.
"You heard me," said Marat.
"I don't understand," said Alan, feeling numb, dazed.
"Sure you do," Marat answered. "Congratulations, Phoenix. You're going into space."
"Wait," said Alan. "I'm not sure. Just do as I say and you'll be fine," said Marat.
Alan did as he was told, his fingers suddenly clumsy. Marat talked him through the next stages. The engagement of an entirely different thrust and navigation system, accessed through a console that had been dark on his previous flights. Now it blazed with illuminated digital diagrams, graphs, and gauges. As Alan's mind raced, Marat kept talking in a level, matter-of-fact voice.
"Okay," said Marat. "I'm synced with your systems remotely, so I can see your status. I'll let you know if anything doesn't look right. But don't worry. The Locust is designed to protect itself, and there'll be no thermal buildup as we go. The ship won't let you do anything crazy or incompetent without making you jump through a whole lot of clarifications and overrides."
"Thanks for that vote of confidence," said Alan. He was, he knew, tipped up on his back, the earth behind him. But he felt quite level, normal even, though his arms felt lighter than usual when he moved them.
"Where exactly are we heading?"
"The upper atmosphere, assuming we don't burn up en route."
"What?"
"Kidding," said Marat. He was enjoying himself. "Like I said, friction is for ordinary pilots. Enter the following coordinates and set your speed range to yellow. As we cross over the mesosphere, another set of subcontrols will activate, and heat shields will close over your windows. You don't need to do anything. But as we emerge, the ship will shift to an entirely different propulsion system. It will feel a little different, but it's quite normal, and you don't need to do anything. These things practically fly themselves."
"So why am I here?" asked Alan.
He was genuinely nervous now, even frightened. Marat just laughed.
"Good one," he said. "Okay, engage when ready. I'll see you on the other side."
Alan closed his eyes for a second, took a breath, and hit what he continued to think of as the ignition. Rightly or not, he had no idea. The ship leapt forward, which was to say, he had to remind himself, that it leapt up. An impossible vertical surge of gravity defying acceleration, accompanied for once by a distinct rumble of energy. Ignition, he decided, was right after all. The Locust's speed was staggering. It didn't so much fly out of the troposphere and into the stratosphere as punch through, getting faster still as it hit the rarefied air of the mesosphere. He was 60 miles above the Earth and climbing at the same staggering rate, the altimeter flashing a constant stream of numbers. 200 knots, 350, 500. And then, at last, with the thermosphere falling away below, the engines powered down, and Alan, sweating for reasons that had nothing to do with the external temperature any ordinary ship would have just generated, looked out. All was suddenly still and silent. Above him was blackness and stars. Below was a pale blue ball, swirled with white, the Earth itself, incandescent in the dark. It was breathtaking.
"This is Nightbird One," said Marat's voice over the headset. "All okay, Phoenix?"
Alan cleared his throat.
"I think so," he said. "Everything looks good."
It was easily the most inadequate thing he had ever said, and that, as Lacey would have pointed out, was saying something. He gazed down into the furthest reaches of space, taking it all in, or trying to, as Marat's voice talked him through what he called the LEO, Low Earth Orbit Operating Systems. "You've got to be more conscious of fuel levels up here," he was saying. "Little bursts are all you need. And try to get the heading right the first time. Constant adjustment reduces dwell time." Alan was barely listening. He was in orbit, higher, in fact, than the International Space Station. And outside his cockpit, the air was so thin, its properties were not very different from the vacuum of space.
he was gazing down from what had been called the heavens for thousands of years, a view few men or women had ever seen with their own eyes. And if someone on the planet's surface somehow got a glimpse of him, he would appear as a star. He had been a pilot. Now he was an astronaut. Which is why all counter-detection measures are automatically engaged as you leave the lower atmosphere. Though that means you have to be alert to your own proximity warnings, Murat explained. Satellites won't move for you, because they won't see you coming. You got that, Major? Phoenix, do you read?
Yeah, said Alan, absently.
Yes, Nightbird One, I'm here, just taking it all insofar as anyone could. Okay, said Murat. Let's try some maneuvering exercises. He either hadn't heard the awe in Alan's voice, or chose to ignore it. For the next hour, Alan flexed the locust's LOE capabilities, moving from point to point, stopping, turning, changing altitudes, and executing a range of rolls and banks, dives and climbs. Surprisingly, and in spite of the fact that every thrust had to be countered by another just to bring the vessel to a halt or change its direction, the Locust functioned more like a conventional aircraft up here. Banks of nozzles along each edge, lit like Cheddar rocket engines, glowing bluish as they fired. So that following Murat, it was almost possible to imagine that they were flying in formation over foreign seas. It was a relief to find something up here that took the edge off the strangeness. Alan found his nervous apprehension draining away as they soared through the blackness over the rolling planet. They kept well clear of the International Space Station. In case someone happens to be looking out the window, Murat said. But they navigated their way through an array of satellites, most of them strange, ungainly things, glittering with gold, and sprouting wing-like solar panels of cobalt blue. Many of them bristled with antennae and dishes, but others looked like the shiny innards of oversized domestic appliances, housings of coils and struts, drums and irregular boxes, discs and tubes, their functions impossible to guess at. None of them would detect the locusts, unless you actually hit them, Murat deadpanned, which we try not to do. What were they worth, Alan wondered, these drifting hunks of technology? Billions, maybe more, all hanging in their orbits for him to waltz around, like a child in a museum after dark. A burst of weapons fire, and he could cripple the business interests or surveillance systems of a dozen countries. In any future conflict involving the USA, the Locust would surely play a part up here. The streak of light came from above, arcing across the blackness, a point of light with a tail. "What's that?" he said. "What do you see, Phoenix?" Murat returned. "Bogey at 11 o'clock. Now 10. Wait." He checked his instruments, but no movement registered. "I've lost it." "Negative on that, Phoenix," said Murat. "Probably a meteor or a piece of space trash burning up on re-entry." Alan craned his neck to stare through the window, bringing the Locust about, almost absent-mindedly as he did so. His instruments were, after all, showing him nothing. He pivoted the Locust. "You're changing heading, Phoenix," Murat said. "Just seeing if I can get a better look," said Alan. "It was nothing. Leave it." "Hold on," Alan mused, firing the Locust's thrusters and shooting forward in the direction of the light he'd seen. For a moment, it was like he was back at Safed Koo, the brilliant light burning in the sky in front of him, his weapons jammed, men, his men, dying on the ground below. "Hold your position, Phoenix," said Murat. "1 second," said Alan. Nothing was shutting his systems down today, not in the Locust, and he wasn't about to let the bogey slip away. He sped toward it, adjusting to go round a satellite that hung like a great shining metal insect in the sky, all legs and antennae. "Phoenix, we have a mission to perform. You need to return." Alan, barely hearing him, said nothing. His attention was riveted to the other vessel up here in the black, where nothing should be.
because he could see it again now. And as he had come around the ungainly satellite, he had seen it. A sleek silver arrowhead, with three blue-white flares on its trailing edge. Engines.
"That's no meteor," he whispered. "Phoenix, I insist that you hold your position," came Marat's voice over his headset.
"There's something up here," Alan replied, staring at it. The ship. It was a ship. It had to be. Banked and accelerated away. His right hand strayed to the console and, with a touch, activated his weapon systems.
"I'm going after it."
35. Jennifer. Heathrow Airport, London. Jennifer had booked her flight from a visibly uneasy ticketing agent, whose eyes kept straying to the smears of dirt she hadn't been able to get off her clothes when she cleaned up. Jennifer thought how lucky it was that her passport was still in her purse. She kept an eye on the airport police, staying close to them where possible, but she did not speak to them. Her mission was to get out of the country, and nothing was to get in the way of that. She had just enough time before her flight to buy a carry-on suitcase and enough overpriced clothes in the airport shops to last her a week. She didn't relax until the plane backed away from the jetway and began to taxi. She flew British Airways to Washington, D.C., landing at Dulles Airport. The destination had almost been selected at random, but not quite. On the plane, she opened up her laptop, paid for Wi-Fi, and read everything she could find on Senator Tom Powers, the Nevada Republican whose name had been in her father's files, a man who had visited their house in her teen years. He looked much the same now as he did then, pale, well-groomed, with ice-blue eyes and a handsome bearing that was as much attitude and confidence as it was bone structure. He was in his late 60s now, what the media called a Washington insider. She emailed his office, saying who she was and requesting a meeting. More misplaced trust? No. Howard's connection to her father was real and proven over time, and she would be more careful about what she told him than she had been with LaTrange. The thought of him needled her. She'd been duped, her instincts manipulated by a skilled liar. How could someone be that good at deception? It was more than work skills. He was a sociopath. She wondered if he was working for anyone other than the Maynard Consortium, but could only find the thinnest of professional profiles online, and nothing telling. Of the Interpol agent Chevalier, there was no online trace at all. She kicked herself again, feeling the old angry spike of humiliation that she had been so completely played. At least he didn't get you into bed first, she thought. Had that been a possibility, part of his long game? She shuddered at the thought, not so much with revulsion, but at the horror of it being all too plausible. She'd considered it. Under other circumstances, it may already have happened. She pushed the thought away, studying her computer and making mental notes, until her eyes ached with the strain, and she closed them for a moment, waking an hour and a half later over the Atlantic Ocean. She woke up her laptop and sent Deacon an email, in which she told him everything except where she was going, asking him to report all that had happened directly to the police. She was taking no chances now. "I'm emailing the police the whole story, and will call them myself once I get settled. I'm sorry. I hope this all blows over soon. I'd like to come home and see you." The rest of the flight was uneventful. Awake now, she stared uncomprehendingly at two different movies, was rude to the middle-aged businessman beside her who tried to flirt with her, and finally slept for the last 2 hours. She was hungry enough to eat whatever they put in front of her, and, as they came into land, drank a Diet Coke. She wanted to be wide awake when they touched down. They landed in Washington at 2 a.m, East Coast time. She saw no sign that anyone was anticipating her arrival, and made her way directly to ground transportation, where she boarded the first hotel shuttle she saw. The driver said there were rooms available, at the Westin in Westin Heights. She had no idea what that was, but it didn't matter. She signed in as a Miss Andrea Bell, though she had to use her credit card to cover her costs, so she doubted that would stand too much scrutiny if anyone was looking for her. The room was on the fifth floor, elegantly modern and spacious, in ways hotels in England almost never were. She set the alarm for 7 and slept. By the time she awoke, there was an email from the office of Senator Tom Powers waiting in her inbox. She read it, changed her clothes, and called a cab. Jennifer had never been to the U.S. Capitol before. She was underwhelmed. The hotel district was new and featureless, and the highway could have been any busy city artery during morning rush hour. It was with something of a shock when she caught her first glimpse of the Washington Monument, stabbing upwards out of the trees over the Potomac. By the time her taxi had left her outside the Hart Building, on Constitution Avenue, there was no doubt that she was in the heart of the world's most powerful government, and was meant to feel its presence. The Hart Building, in spite of its marble facade, was blockish and modern-looking, without the neoclassical elegance of its surroundings. It felt utilitarian, which was fine as far as Jennifer was concerned. She didn't want to be overawed any more than was strictly necessary. Power's office was on the third floor, above the central hearings chamber. Jennifer looked for an elevator, crossing the grade 8.